running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. It feels like I am living in the wasteland. We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. But they'll fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. If you don't like it, mister, they'll ship your job to some third world country across the sea. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland. Little kids with guns fighting inner city wars. So what do? We put these little kids behind prison doors.
Okie dokie. The fade downs there tell you that... Whoopsie daisy. That's so much better. The fade downs there tell you that in all probability here, because it's 1 p.m. on the almost the last day of January, the longest month in forever... This is probably the Zentech radio show, and what we do from 1 till 2 here on the community radio is listen to and talk about and think about and millicate and masticate, if I dare say it, all things tech. The two of us, the mischief makers, the heroes. Of,
Mr. Pauly Castro.
Yeah, and Mr. Glenn Farr.
Hi.
But in the opposite order. Hello. What are we going to do? You're the man, Glenn. Here's what happens. You should know that you are listening to KVMR FM, Nevada City, KCPC Camino with... Translator K289BM Grass Valley, K258DG Angels Camp at 99.5, K286AN Truckee at 105.1 FM, Translator K230CA Woodland 93.9 FM, and finally KVMR HD2 Nevada City. All those means are available for you to find us if you're in our area. And if you're not in our area and you're in the outer reaches of Outer Mongolia or Inner Mongolia's capital, Hoi Hot, or Beijing, or Peiping, wherever the heck you are, why not visit KVMR.org and listen to us screaming live? Streaming.
Streaming, and sometimes we are screaming.
Yeah, so. Live worldwide. First up, we have some stuff to talk about, which is what exactly goes on in our community. Would that sound like the right thing for us to do, Glenn?
That sounds like the right thing.
I will drag this microphone over here. Mm-hmm. The notion is when you're doing radio, don't tell people what you're doing, even though it's not TV. You can guess I'm probably doing something with the microphone, and it's probably illegal.
Yeah, because we got it. Well, no.
First up. Onward. First up, the film Vox Lux will be shown on Sunday, 7 p.m. at the Nevada Theater in downtown Nevada City. It tells... the story of the pop star Celeste. Website is sierratheaters.com.
The Doodads perform old favorites and lost treasures on Saturday, 5 to 8 p.m. at the Cork 49 Wine Bar, 142 Mill Street in Grass Valley. The Doodads Band.wixsite. That's WIXSITE.com.
An exhibit of hyper-realistic collage created by artist Andra Asbdok will go on display at the Broad Street Bistro in Nevada City through the month of February. A reception for the artist will be held on Saturday, and that's noon until 3 p.m. I've got to spell this one out for you. abdockstudio.com. That's AABDOCK studio.com.
The original play, Make Believe, will be shown at the Nevada Theater beginning this Friday through February 3rd. Written, scored, and directed by Dalrymple McAlpin, the play is an archetypal musical theater fairy tale for the young and young at heart. Performances are at 7:30 p.m., except for the 2 p.m. Sunday matinees. PaulEmeryMusic.com.
Jim Malcolm will perform traditional and contemporary songs from Scotland using guitar and harmonicas, and that's on Sunday 3 until 5 p.m. And this is at a private home in Auburn. Learn more at auburnhouseconcerts.org.
The public is invited to an evening of music with Gary Lynn Floyd and Jamie Lula on Wednesday. That's tonight, 7 p.m. at the Sierra Center for Spiritual Living, 119 Florence Avenue in Grass Valley, sierracenter.org.
Featuring a sensational live kids rock band called School of Rock the Musical, and this will be performed beginning Thursday tomorrow at the Nevada Union High School in Grass Valley. School of Rock is a two-hour, two-act musical based on the hit movie. Performances will be on Thursday, tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday evenings, starting 7 p.m. this weekend and next. Website is nudrama.com.
I think I might go see that. It sounds like that would be a lot of fun. The Stone House in Nevada City offers two later evening shows this week. On Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight, the Funk Hunters will put the soul back into electronic dance music. And on Saturday evening at 9:30 p.m., Mojo Green, a horn-driven funk and soul band will perform. Stonehouse.io.
Love it. Horn-driven. California Organics in Nevada City is hosting live music from three times through, and that's on Friday from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. The website, californiaorganics.com.
Playing at the Crazy Horse in Nevada City, Friday, Soul Horizon pays tribute to the music of Bob Marley, 9:30 p.m., and on Saturday, Dusty Green Bones brings jam, grass, and Americana, 10 p.m. CrazyHorseNC.com.
I can't keep up with all the music genres. Can you, Glenn? I found one that was called Fast Blues. It's like, how can it be blues if it's fast? But it was. All right. Music in the Mountains presents the Young Composers Project called The New Songs for Midwinter in a concert featuring new works of music written by local youth and inspired by poetry and poets. This concert takes place on Saturday from 2 until 4 p.m. at Peace Lutheran Church in Grass Valley. Website? musicinthemountains.org.
The Center for the Arts on the Go series presents Bay Area Bluegrass Band Front Country at the Grass Valley Oddfellows Lodge this Saturday evening. Singer-songwriter Brett Shady opens at 8 p.m. thecenterforthearts.org.
Gucho Musto perform at the 1840 Brewing Company in Grass Valley on Saturday from 8 until 11 p.m. The website, GuccioMusto.com. You know what to do next, don't you, Glenn?
Well, I do, except it's not...
Can you remember the words?
Not there. Is it up at the top? There it is. Okay.
Oh, look at that. Yeah, go, Glenn, go.
More information is available on these and many other events at kvmr.org under the Community Menu tab. To send us your event announcement, go to kvmr.org and click on the Submit PSA button found on the top of any page. We're going to go ahead and open up with Pentatonix, Daft Punk Medley.
Use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag and drop it, zip, unzip it, lock it, mirror, call it, find it, view it, play it, jam, unlock it, surf it, scroll it, pause it, click it, cross it, back it, switch it, fade it, name it, rate it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, text, rename it, touch it, print it, play it, watch it, technologic.
One more time. One more time.
Like the legend of the Phoenix, yeah. All ends with beginnings.
That's the fade-out point. I've got to say, I was talking to Glenn during that musical intermission there to say, you know, we are tuned like a fine Swiss watch. We go back, we go forth, and then we go back again. Just like now.
One day I'd like to talk to you about watches, because I was talking to somebody about taking them apart and repairing them. And you know, there are, I don't know if there are thousands of parts inside a wristwatch, but at least hundreds of parts. And it's amazing that somebody ever came up with all of that.
Well, you know what? They look like biologists when they do it, because concentrating down binocular microscopes looking at amoeba is not a lot different from what a watchmaker does, which is a binocular. And that's not the correct term. It's binocular microscope, which helps them see in 3D, magnified, and steady hands and a platform to rest your wrists. And increasingly, there's all sorts of robotic manipulation tools that allow you to make very fine movements. Two things a watchmaker has got to do, and a surgeon, which is be capable of fine movements and be steady-handed. Not everybody's got that attribute. I find I am cack-handed where repairing small stuff is concerned.
We want to take a moment and just say thank you. Not just say thank you. We want to say thank you to all of you for being a part of KVMR, and also offer our thanks out to the following business. And they include businesses. They include Sacramento Natural Foods Co-op, presenting the class 10 Weeks to Vegan. Participants will learn the basics for a plant-based diet and taste vegan Thai yellow curry. That's Tuesday, February 5th at 6 p.m. Information at sac.coop.
Harris Center for the Arts at Folsom Lake College presenting Luis Bravo's Cumparacita. And that features Argentinian musicians and dancers telling the story of the art of tango in this North American debut. Three shows, February the 13th and 14th. Ticket information at harriscenter.net.
And the Harris Center for the Arts at Folsom Lake College presenting Los Vivancos, featuring seven brothers in their own extreme fusion dance company, blending flamenco, ballet, martial arts, street dance, theater, and acrobatics. That'll be Monday, February 18th. Ticket information at harriscenter.net.
All right, so that's led us through all the procedures that tell you that our community station here tells you what's going on, what's happening, what's been. A lot of stuff going on here. What you got for us, young Glenn? A couple things came up, wasn't there? Yeah, you look baffled. Do you remember? Was it Zell?
Yes.
Yes! Yes, what a team.
It's not so new anymore, but there are a few payment options out there through your banks, and there's one actually. I don't even know if you have to do it through your bank or give them your banking information. Mm-hmm. The one that I'm familiar with is Zelle. One of the others is Venmo, and there might be a couple of others out there. And I've been using Zelle through Wells Fargo Bank, and I know Chase Bank also has it. And what you can do is, let's say you're out to dinner with somebody, and one person can pay the check, and then later you can split the bill, and you can send out using Zelle fee-free, just using either a email address or a cell phone number to direct money to a friend. In my case, I also use it for an organization that I belong to. I paid my yearly dues back in the beginning
of the
month.
So you're saying it's associated with the email address that's used to assign the account?
Correct.
So it's got a PayPal-like quality, except instead of going to PayPal, goes to the other person's bank.
Right. Ah. And I did have an experience a couple of weeks ago. I have an online bank, and I wanted to set it up there. Mm-hmm. And I realized I can't use my email address at both banks. So I did try using my real cell phone number, and it came back and told me, this isn't a cell number. We need a cell number. So I thought, well, let me just reverse the order. I'll put my email at that online bank, and I'll use my cell number at Wells Fargo. And sure enough, at Wells Fargo,
it said it wasn't a cell number.
Correct.
There's no way, by the way, there is no way in the United States to know that for sure. If you have a Verizon, a real Verizon, or a real AT&T, or a real T-Mobile, or a real Sprint number, they are the major carriers. But there's all these MVNOs. And what happens is, if you're not on one of those major carriers, or like I am on Total Wireless, or like you are on H2O, I think.
Pure Talk USA now.
That's probably why. But you found a way around it.
Yes, well, just by using my email for that particular, for Wells Fargo. And I do have another email, and I'll set
so
that up.
So it is instantaneous?
It is fairly instantaneous. I have
so the recipient can see that the credit appeared in the account?
Yes, they get an email or a text message, whichever way you have it set up.
Is it bounceable?
I do not believe so, because it's, you know...
So it's a guaranteed delivery. When you get the money, it's the real thing.
I, as far as I know, that's correct.
So it's irrevocable is the other name for it, unless it's fraud.
Yes.
So it's not like a check where you had a period of time when you could stop the thing.
Right.
Right. And what we're watching out for, of course, Glenn, you know how circumspect we are here on this show. How, I wonder, is that open to fraud? So if I sent you money and somebody intercepted your email and saw the notification that says, okay, click on this link to accept the money that came from Polly. So somebody stole your email. They would still need the password for the system to get in and accept the payment. And plus, it would go into your account, not theirs.
Yes, right. Yes.
Okay, so I know somebody's going to subvert it, but it sounds, I mean, I've never really had a problem with PayPal, except for the fact that it goes through an intermediary, which is it's held at PayPal until then as a second stage, you move it back and forth to your bank. So
yeah.
I'm going to look at that. By the way, we're not endorsing this stuff. I'm going in the real world in which we exist, as opposed to the fantasy world in which I wish we existed. Money appears to be necessary along with breathing and food. I wish it weren't, and it's not as necessary as we think. But while we are committed to this master of our lives, let us make it the slave of our activities.
Yes.
That's what we do. We make technology our slave, Lord our master. We try to put it there anyway. You know what I mean? What was the other one? You said Zelle and something else.
Again, I don't remember.
And it should theoretically be possible, if you're selling tickets for somebody, to give them your email address so that they could then send a payment. But they would need the Zelle system themselves, right? It has to go between people that hold a Zelle account.
Correct. And I don't know that there are any banks now that don't support Zelle.
Okay. And it's not independent. It's a service provided by the bank.
Well, Zelle is independent, and the banks have subscribed
gotcha,
to it.
Gotcha, yeah. Interestingly enough, hate to say this to our American listeners, because we are broadcasting on the continent of America. This is old hat for Europeans who have Postbank and Giro, which is an interbank transfer system. Partly because, I hate to say it, as a socialized, nationalized system, it was mandated in charter that banks are for the public good, profit though they make. So that it should be made as simple as possible. So if I wanted to pay you, I'd simply go into a post office, as it used to be, mm-hmm. or to a bank, and you only need to know the account number of the person to whom the deposit is being made. In the old days, it was done by paper. Mm-hmm. Now it's done online. In Japan, they don't use checks. It's always interbank transfers, always. I used to get paid when I was a teacher there as an interbank transfer. Mm-hmm. Every month or 2 weeks or whatever it was, an amount would go into my bank. Now, direct pay, a direct deposit is done here.
Yes.
So if you can imagine that being done all the time from everyone, it gives the name of the person paying you, it gives you everything. So we're moving right along there, right, Glenn?
Yeah.
Nah.
Let's remind folks, our website, zen.kvmr.org, and Paulie, as usual, has got some great notes up there for today, January 30th.
Did you see the stuff?
I'm looking at it right now. And then also, you can email us anytime you'd like to at zen@kvmr.org. Looking at the homework for today from last week,
yeah.
We had the micro bit, and then this week we've got... How about the Pi Zero, all from Raspberry Pi? It'd be your own DJ-free mix. It can read iTunes playlists, steep learning curve, though.
Yes.
Linux users of WMA Office, LibreOffice, where's Arial, Veranda, etc.
Verdana, their fonts,
yeah. Verdana, okay. Tiny Real Virtual Servers. Volter and DigitalOcean, and fixing an iPod Classic with 1.8-inch 40-pin drive.
What do you think of that? Does it make sense?
Oh,
I mean, they remind me, and then our good friend down in SAC, I think it is, Alex, will transcribe what we actually enlarge on this and talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that good man sometimes will actually follow our links and very politely correct the stuff which I winged off and zinged into the site in 10 seconds flat before I headed out the door. The homework is typically stuff that came up between the last show and this.
Yes.
There is obviously more. Some people out there, and it's somewhat nerdy, know what a Pi Zero is. There are some very small computers out there. I was amazed to learn that of those of you that have not heard of Raspberry Pi, now you'll say, isn't that what my grandmother used to make from a stump row?
Mm-hmm.
Well, not really. All these machineries have got bizarre names. The word Pi comes from the language Python, apparently.
Yeah.
And the language Python came into existence, I don't know, 15, 18 years ago. And the fellow that invented the language Python did so because he wanted a name for his language that didn't conflict with any other existing languages, and he found most of the names he wanted to use were used up, but nobody had used Python, and he liked Monty Python, so he used that. I mean, it's come an enormously long way, so I'm learning using this tiny platform called the Raspberry Pi. It's a computer on a little board that's no more than a couple inches square. Mm-hmm. It uses a 5-volt power supply with a micro USB connector. It's got little LEDs on it to tell you what it's doing. Incredibly, this 2-inch square circuit board has an HDMI output, so you plug it into your TV. Used to be a dreadful compromise plugging a computer into a TV set. Remember when that was got going for home computers?
Yes, yes.
With a crummy old 40 column by 20 line display, and you could see the raster, and you squinted like a mad thing. Now this tiny Raspberry Pi, if you've got one, can drive. What did we see in Costco, Glenn? Was it an 81-inch diagonal display?
Yes.
LED TV system. It's perfectly happy to drive that. It's got a tremendously high resolution. It has, most of them have got USB ports. You can plug a mouse, keyboard, 5-volt power supply, and an HDMI TV into the thing.
And it also includes Wi-Fi, Bluetooth.
The Raspberry Pi, it sounds like talking about automobiles here, the Raspberry Pi Model 3B, I think it is, has got Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. It's got everything that a modern-day laptop or desktop computer would have. Mm. On the other hand, don't buy this as a home computer. There's some special features of the thing. But if you've got members of your family who love hacking around with technology, or if that's your thing, it knows no bounds, no age. It's not actually fully understood what everybody uses these Raspberry Pi for. They're called embedded systems because they are solid-state with flash drives, blah, 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 all the rest of it. At last count, and this amazed me, the Raspberry Pi, which many of you may never have heard of, is the third highest selling hardware platform.
Wow.
First is the PC platform, meaning the architecture given over to putting Windows on.
And then Apple?
And then Apple is right after that, so that's the second largest vendor of hardware. It gets a bit confusing because Microsoft doesn't make their own hardware. Right. But the principal platform, 85% of people out there are using, is the PC platform, for want of a better word. Up around, I believe, 9 or 10% or so is the Mac platform, and that encounters all things iPod, MacBook Pro, MacBook Air, all the rest of it. The third one's a Raspberry Pi. The sales have gone through the 20 million mark.
Wow.
Now, you may not see them, but they're inside all sorts of things. I'm making a security camera with mine using cheap web camera. I'm also making it into a weather station. You can buy humidity, liquid, temperature, and barometric pressure sensors for about, get this, $2 a piece. It doesn't look like something that you would give to your grandmother right after dinner as a Christmas present. It's all clear plastic boxes and flashing lights and dingle-dangle cables. The other thing to bear in mind is it's safe around children because it only uses 5 volts. However, it's got small parts.
Yes.
The other thing is pets, for some reason, like them because they're warm and will sit on them and chew the cables. Mine do. But I believe personally, it's a great hobby thing. It's got a short, sharp, vigorous learning curve because although the off-the-shelf price for one of these things, the Raspberry Pi 3B, I think it is, costs $32, I think it is.
I was going to guess right around that range.
Around that range. That's the upper limit. Once you've learned with that, that's the platform on which you learn because it's got every bell and whistle interface and everything else. You can buy a Raspberry Pi Zero, which has got most of that extra stuff shaved off. So when you've developed what you want on the big guy, you pull out the little tiny micro SD card, push it into the Pi Zero, and it will do everything that happened on the bigger one. It's got a little bit less space, uses a bit less power, physically takes less volume, and has a few less interfaces. But the latest Pi Zero, which is about the size of a chewing gum stick, has got a Wi-Fi interface on it. So I'm going to use the Pi Zero to control my Roomba vacuum cleaner. Go, Polly, why would you do that? It's already got electronics on board. It's a robot. Hey, guys, remember the Curiosity rover that's running around on Mars is a robot. But it does tell you what it's doing, and you can tell it where to go. So it's what you might call an autonomous system that cleans your house. But you can also put a camera on it and also make it map where it's going. It's a toy, guys. You know, there's cleaning the house and then there's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. We're actually thinking of getting one of those, too. One of the Roombas to do, because we have installed carpeting, I can't remember what you call that, but you know, regular carpeting, and then also hardwood floors.
They are better about carpeting than they were, but the problem with what will happen with a robotic vacuum cleaner that doesn't exist with a conventional Hoover-type upright beater and sucker vacuum cleaner is it's battery-powered, so the suction is not particularly good. What it does have that you and I don't have is patience. It will trundle around the house for an hour or two. Mm-hmm. It will also creep into the furthest corners. It does best with the kind of stuff that it can whisk up with its little spinning brushes. The suction is only enough to lift it into the dirt tray. It doesn't have strong suction. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't. So what happens is I am not deprived of the luxurious ability to use my upright vacuum cleaner, but it certainly takes a dent out of pet hair and stuff hiding in the corners and under the beds. It happily drives under the bed and sweeps up the dust bunnies. Sometimes you can hear it choking on them. That tells you how I live.
That's why I'd like one. Is for those little dust bunnies under the bed.
I think you could actually knit a sweater out of what I found in dust bunnies. So yeah, we're sort of digressing a bit. But anyway, those links there will tell you something about these things. In many instances, you can buy on the likes of Amazon or the wonderful websites banggood.com or AliExpress. You can buy what they call a starter kit, which is for a few extra fistful of dollars, comes with the little flash memory. What you get is a bare-bones system. If you get a beginner or starter kit, it'll have a few illustrations that say, you know, plug this power in here, plug that power in there, put this card in there, just follow the instructions, turn it on, and in no time, well, few minutes, you will be operating a mouse on a screen with a fully graphical interface that looks somewhat like Windows, operating applications that amazingly are running in a tiny low-powered box. It is actually spectacular.
What is the operating system? Is it Pi?
You can choose several. Most people use Linux.
Okay.
In a form called Raspbian, and that's based on the fact that it's Debian Linux running on a Raspberry Pi. Do not be intimidated by these words. In the end, all they mean is it's a shorthand form of way of reminding you that this is what it's set for. It's all free. The operating system doesn't cost anything. You do have to be good at following instructions. And once in a while, it takes a good faith effort to not try and understand what's going on, which I hate. When I first started using this, I didn't understand a number of things. And then I actually yelled out loud, oh, that's why they do that. So that's a great learning experience, that aha moment, which is the Zen part of Zen Tech.
Yes. Aha,
right?
Yay.
Yay. Anyway, that's just strictly nerdy stuff. What do you know about DJing? Have you ever done it?
No.
Well, you got iTunes, so you must have put playlists in iTunes. That's kind
of... Music is not a big part of my life. So iTunes is confusing. And DJing, there would be no way that I could figure that out.
Well, I've got a confession to make, young Ben. Are you ready for this? And it's on air in front of millions of our listeners worldwide. And that's the fact is that I thought, being a technical person, I would be able to do this. So I got a free piece of DJing software called Mix. And it's spelled with three X's, so it's easy to find with Google. mixxx.org, and it's listed up there as a second piece of homework. If you're somebody who uses iTunes and has playlists, you might think, well, why would you want anything else? Because you've got your playlists, your 10 best songs and your 10 party pieces and your 10 mellow pieces, you know, whatever it is, however you set your playlist up for. When you bring up Mix, M-I-X-X-X, it's free software, Mac and PC.
Mm-hmm.
I love learning this way, which is I hate being out of pocket for learning something I, in the end, didn't care for. So my confession to you in front of everybody is I loaded up this DJ software and I was out on a limb. I'm going, I have no idea how this works because I've never done DJing before, but I'm certainly into it.
Mm-hmm.
The paradigm is two turntables.
Mm-hmm.
You cue up on one and play on the other. There's a crossfader between the two, just about as soon as I started to get used to it. So what you can do is you can pick up your playlist from iTunes, which Mix knows how to do. You can cue up on the left turntable, as it's called. It's physically graphical on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where it gets interesting. The Mac or the PC typically has one audio output.
Uh-huh.
A speaker output.
Mm-hmm.
If you add a second audio output, most PCs and Macs don't have that, but you can get a cheap audio device and connect it to a headphone, so it's now got two audio outputs. One in your headphones, one in the speaker. This is a really basic system, okay? If you do nothing else, get yourself a USB adapter that gives you a headphone jack, and they cost about $4 or $5.
Mm-hmm.
The Mac or the PC will then identify a second output with a name like USB audio. The speaker goes out where it always went out, through the speaker socket. The second audio that you've added goes to your headphones. This is where you get to be the DJ. So far, so good. My confession hasn't come up yet.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're doing is you're playing on the left side out through the speaker from your playlist, whatever it is you think is appropriate. On the right side, you designate the output to your headphones. And this is where it gets tricky because it depends how your brain works. I'm not sure how you can listen to one piece of music while another's blasting out. You have to kind of flip your brain. The other thing, of course, if you've got decent headphones, they will block off the external sound. You shouldn't have to crank your phones to overcome the noise of whatever it is you're DJing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I started to get baffled. This bloody thing is covered in so many buttons and so many choices and so many different ways of doing things. You can cue things, you can speed them up, you can slow them down. It even detects the beat in the music. So if you've got one piece of music in the left turntable at 60 beats, which is about your heart rate, and on the right-hand side it's at 90, which is somewhat faster, you can, if you want, I'm not saying you should do, it'll detect the beats and you can slow down the right-hand piece to match.
And then it'll ramp up to its, or it'll either stay there at the same beat.
You can do two things. You can change the pitch and change the speed.
Okay.
So you're seriously messing with the music. And this is where I got lost, because at some point I'm going, this is going really well. And I'm going, where am I? Now, it wasn't a public event. I was just doing this at home. And I'm going, thank God nobody's dancing out there. They'd be on the floor going, what are you doing? So I got completely lost, but I loved it. There's nothing like making mistakes. And every time I open it up and try again, I go, there you go, that hello moment. Oh, that's why it's set up that way, you know? If you're somebody that's used to physical turntables and scratching and mixers and all that kind of crap, you should be home free, because that's the paradigm on your screen. It looks just exactly like that.
Now, can you do that? Is that scratching, where you've got, you know, both records kind of going?
I believe you can. I don't go for it, but you can. Okay. Yes, you can.
I see that as more of an option on a touchscreen device, right, as opposed to a computer where you're just using your mouse.
I think it's a little slider that you do it with. So it's like, I mean, oh, and the other thing is you can connect what they call MIDI devices for it. So there are, for about 40, 50, 60 bucks, a device you can connect to the USB, which, listen to this, has got two tiny little rubber turntables on it and a couple of actual real physical sliders. So you're interfacing with the software on the screen in such a way that it looks like the hardware the formal DJ would use.
Okay.
And it's so cheap. So if you paid $40 for that MIDI interface to provide control services, nothing for the software, and a few lost neurons and brain cells and the good ears of your neighbors who are dancing around to whatever you're doing. Mm-hmm. I love this stuff. I'm having a blast. It's completely pointless. It doesn't earn me any money. I'm making mistakes all the time. I'm having a blast.
Have you brought back Music Tuesdays in your house?
Music Tuesdays?
Yeah.
What's that?
You used to have, a few years ago when I moved in with you in Sachiko, you had Music Tuesdays. And so Tuesdays you would either play music, make music, and rock out.
I forgot about that.
You remember that now?
I want to do it again.
Yes.
But that was yesterday.
Okay.
Or in 6 days.
Yes.
I will do that and you're above. Actually, I was playing music very, very loud yesterday. The sparrows were falling off the trees. The chickens ran away. The dog, who is deaf, actually looked up. Mm-hmm. Like, what is going on? And the windows were shaking. So I don't often play music loud, but when I do, the neighbors know.
Mm-hmm.
Music Tuesdays. Thank you, Glenn.
Yeah. We do have somebody on hold on the phone. I'm not sure we're quite ready to go to you yet, but let me let everyone know, again, this is KVMR-FM, Nevada City, KCPC Camino, and our phone number, 530-265-9555. We put you on hold when you call in, and then we take your call as they come in order, and we will read our...
The
views expressed on this show are those of the speakers only and not necessarily those of KVMR, our board, staff, volunteers, or contributors.
I would say that's true.
Did you want to go through the rest of the homework?
I was going to do a quick one, then we'll get a call. For my friend here, I don't use the Office products, but we spoke about WMA Office, if you remember, and mm-hmm. LibreOffice and OpenOffice and all those things. You use Word and those things more often than I do. And I, as far as I can tell, WMA Office was very compatible. It behaves a lot like, for better or worse, it behaves a lot like Word.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And then Alan Stoller pointed out it hasn't got Arial and Verdana.
Okay,
which are the default fonts, the standard fonts. That's a bit bad. If you're trying to be compatible, that's 9 times out of 10 the font that will be there. It turns out that they are licensed from Microsoft, and you can get them, but they don't come as part of the standard distribution. You have to go and download them. It seems weird that when you distribute a copy of the Linux operating system, which is free, there is software which is free that you aren't allowed to distribute, but you can download it. I go, don't argue with it. It's just the way it is. So if you're one of those people who has a Linux operating system, which is a non-commercial operating system, there is no direct license for the distributors of Linux to give those things away. The link up there will allow you to download, install them. They're free. And it says, I agree to the license terms of Microsoft for installing Arial, Verdana, and there's a couple other fonts in there too. Then they're available. Then you will see them on the font menu of the various programs that you use, whether it's LibreOffice or WMA Office. Yeah.
I remember now when I had that quizzical look earlier, speaking of the fonts, and I can't remember the situation that I heard this on. I listen to the news a lot, and I try to pass things on to you folks, but in relations to fonts, there were some legal issues recently.
Oh, yeah.
And
hell yeah.
They were able to find out, like, the person, I don't know, it was the perpetrator of whatever was going on, you know, said, you know, here's a document that, you know, was created and signed in 1994, and here's one in 2007 that added to it or made this different.
Yeah.
And they went in, and I don't know if just somebody randomly happened to think about it or if they actually were going into forensics to look at it. Mm-hmm. Everything was created like 3 weeks before, like in 2018.
So there's a forensic that could confirm that.
Yeah, because the fonts they were using hadn't been invented back in the dates that they thought.
Oh, it was what they call an anachronistic indictment, which you couldn't have been there. You couldn't have done that.
Yeah, right.
Brilliant. There's an issue, which is most of the fonts used nowadays are of a type known as TTF, true type fonts, which are basically data files that store a lot more than you can see. It has clues about the way in which the font can be moved and shaped. Many of them are commercial fonts, so those of you out there that do graphic design or typesetting, a lot of the fonts, and it's a special area of the artistic realm right there between technology and artistry, there are some very, very beautiful fonts out there. And it doesn't mean they're free just because you've got them or you loaded them on your machine and all the rest of it. Several companies out there digitize these fonts. One of them is known as Bitstream. The other one, of course, is Adobe, who are one of the collaborators in the production of the TrueType font standard, which Apple and Microsoft and so on collaborated on. There's a huge number of free fonts out there, but just because you got it for free doesn't mean it is free. Mm. I don't know who'd pursue it. In the early days of Microsoft Word, for example, you'd open up Microsoft Word, pick a font from the menu, type your letter that would use the font that was on your machine, the TrueType font. It would render it in the point size, blah, 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 all the rest of it. Now, when you send that to somebody else, what happens if they don't have that font on their machine? The nature of the TrueType font data file is that it's got clues in it about what family of font it belongs to, what general density it has, blah, blah, blah. Typography is a whole profession in itself and totally interesting. It'll substitute a font which it thinks is a reasonable match, which is why sometimes things don't look quite the way they were when you sent them.
And your formatting can change because of that
will bump the formatting. It'll do all sorts of odd things. That's why people started using PDFs, portable document format, because it created a rasterized, or basically digitized into dots, form. In some instances, also with Microsoft Word in its day, it was possible to embed the font in a read-only format, so the recipient could open the document looking correct with the font it was written in, containing the TrueType font that did it, but a very lame form of digital rights management was supposed to prevent that font from being extracted. The other thing was, it wasn't the complete font set, it was just sufficient of the font that was required to render the document. So they got around it by saying, well, if this document doesn't actually contain most of the uppercase characters and doesn't contain any of the weird punctuations, what you'll get isn't a complete set. So that's how they dealt with it. It's like, steal it if you like, but you're only getting whatever was used in this document. Interesting stuff. All major platforms now use TrueType fonts, and that includes Linux. But if you want Arial and Verdana, you have to download it from Microsoft, and the link's tell you how to do that.
Yeah, I just brought up Google Docs, which I don't use that often to mm-hmm. create documents. Mm-hmm. And I was going to look in here at fonts because there's one that comes up as a default, and I don't see it here in Google Docs, but on Microsoft Office, it starts with a C, and I don't know if it's
Century.
No, it's Calibra.
Calibra, yeah.
Is that a correct
I've seen
name?
It, but I don't know what it is. Yeah.
Okay. And because I prefer Arial or Arial Black as my standard, just because it's simple and
by
I'm not...
By the way, most of these companies now make a huge amount of money selling the licensed technology for their fonts to the likes of Apple for the screens of their iPhones, because it's very critical in a small space what font you use to make it utterly legible. There's also fonts from Bitstream that go into LCD displays. You wouldn't think so, but now that OLEDs are becoming common, which is the organic LED displays, they've got a very, very fine pixel density, which means the fonts are generated by using a lot of pixels to render the outline of the font very clearly. It's no longer that ugly-looking kind of ASCII fonty thing. So these companies make massive amounts of money. I saw a documentary which is fascinating to me about the font Helvetica. If you look up a documentary about Helvetica, you wouldn't think fonts were so interesting. Helvetia was the old name for Switzerland. The photographer or the fontmeister who designed Helvetica back in 1960s, I think it was. The documentary showed what I'd always taken for granted, which is why was it signs looked a certain way they did before the 1960s, and after the 1960s they looked completely different. It's like, how the heck does a font change the style of society around you? Documentary about Helvetica, you wouldn't believe how interesting it was. Not just for a nerd.
Okay.
You know, the personalities involved, I love stuff like that. Hey, should we take a call? I've yammered enough.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and take this call. You are live on the air. Caller, what's your first name?
Afternoon, Glenn. This is Neil.
Hi, Neil. How are you today?
I have pretty good. I have a interesting problem here.
Oh, good.
Were you talking about batteries on your last program?
We did.
Well, I ran into something. I bought some rechargeable batteries uh-huh. from Home Depot.
Okay.
Not Home Depot, Harbor Freight.
Okay.
They're NiCad batteries. And I charged them up, and I put them in my cordless phone here. And they don't work.
At all?
At all.
Okay, well...
But if I put them in a flashlight, they work just fine.
Then the question is, why did you... Go ahead, Neil.
Here's the interesting thing. If I just replace one of them, then it works.
Okay. Oh, I love puzzles like this. I've got several thoughts. First off, it makes me curious that you replace the batteries in the... You're talking about a cordless phone, right?
Correct.
You must have replaced them in the cordless phone because the cordless phone had some kind of trouble.
Well, they're probably 4 years old or so.
Right.
And they can only be recharged so often.
Right. I'm guessing there's something wrong with the contact. It always behoves us when we have battery-powered stuff to get a bit of emery board, and where the studs on the battery make contact, clean it off gently with emery board, like a nail file thingy, and on the batteries themselves. The other thing, Neil, that I've got that's incredibly useful, probably from Harbor Freight, is a battery tester. So that you remove one unknown, which is, well, the battery's okay. Now, in your scenario, it may well be that one battery works and the other one's not so good. Right?
That's what I was thinking. And when you said that you put one of the original batteries with one of the new batteries in the cordless phone, that did work. So in that case, I was wondering if, and Paulie or Neil, you might know this, that still completes the series, but it may only be using power from that one battery.
You're generally advised not to mix batteries like that, because what may happen is one battery with more current in it will dump that current through a weaker battery and corrode it or result in overheating. But for the purpose of a test, I think that's interesting. So when you pop out the original battery and replace it with one of the new batteries, it then does not work any longer.
Correct.
Is it not working at all, like nothing at all on the screen, or working badly?
Just completely blank.
Yeah, the answer is going to be in this.
As if he had no battery in there at all.
As if nothing was in there. I've also seen the fact that sometimes where the batteries go into a unit, there's a clever interlock mechanism to make sure you can't use the battery the wrong way round. Have you ever seen that? So there's a dimple on the positive end of the battery, and there's a little pimple or stub in the case where the battery goes.
Right.
And in the opposite end, there's like a recess cutout. So if you put the battery in the wrong way around, the stud on the positive end will go into the recess and not complete the circuit. Now, that's all very well and good, and that's the intention of the design. All batteries are slightly different. I would look real closely at where those contacts are, and I've been known to get tweezers or needle nose pliers and bend out those things and look closely at what's happening. I'll bet that there's a physical difference between the two batteries. They've probably got equally good voltage in them, but one of them is physically different and not making successful contact for some reason.
And when you're using the batteries in the flashlight, are you using them individually, or does the flashlight use two batteries also?
Uses two.
Okay, and right. They work there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a fun thing to do, troubleshooting, and most of us are not geared up for critical thinking about this. But you could get to it by saying, well, how about if you take one of the rechargeable batteries when you put your original single battery in the phone, it works. When you put a rechargeable battery in the replacement in there, it doesn't. Put the other replacement battery in there, and see, I'll bet you get the same story.
Yeah, I've tried all combinations.
Yeah, all combinations. So my inclination, I'd love it if you got back to us, Neil, is to think that the physical contacts there are not doing their job. And in general, because everything's got bloody batteries in it these days, I would get a cheap battery tester. The one I have has got an LCD display, and it tells you the voltage in the battery. And it must put a slight load on the battery. It's important when you measure the voltage on a battery that you put a small load on it. And nickel-cadmium batteries, when they're fully charged, I think, like yours, are supposed to be 1.29 volts or something like that. It's a little chart on the back that says what you can expect from lithium polymer batteries, from carbon batteries, from alkaline batteries, and so on.
Yeah, I checked them with my multimeter, and they were fully charged.
Right, and you've got to be that's usually okay, but the multimeter is deliberately designed to not put a load current on because it's measuring voltage. A battery tester, I would put a few hundred ohms of resistance there to see what it does under load, and if it plummets, it means the internal condition of the battery is crummy. Not likely with a new battery, but you see where I'm going with that. So, yeah, will you get back to us about that? And I do suspect after cleaning the studs and bending them a little bit with needle nose pliers or tweezers that you may have some more luck.
Okay, yeah, I'll give that a shot, but I'm a little skeptical about it.
Quite right, too. That's the core of critical thinking. It doesn't matter how much it looks like it is so. If you think critically, it probably ain't.
Right.
All right. So, do please get back to us, and we'll relay your story on next show. How's that sound?
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot, Neil.
Okay. Take care, guys.
Yeah. Bye. Bye-bye now. We have three more calls on the line. Do you want to take another
call? Why not? Yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon, caller. Thank you for holding your live on the air. What's your first name?
Steve.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Hey, I got a question on software. I use a popular CAD program, and I was looking on the internet, and I see that they have older versions of this CAD program for sale. Now, they're not authorized dealers, though, who sell those.
Mm.
And from what I've read, they buy them. These are older versions of the software. And they buy them abroad, and then they sell them back. They get a big discount, and they sell them back to people in the United States. My question is that legal software or what?
We can mention the name. I'm guessing this is probably AutoCAD, is it?
That's probably right.
Probably right. Okay, but I didn't say that. The situation has changed substantially. So if the software is old enough, what happens is newer software checks in with the mothership. So if you've got Microsoft Office or AutoCAD, latest version or whatever it is, it has to activate itself by connecting and communicating over the internet, right?
Yeah.
So if you buy a piece of software and they say, this is a legitimate key, and you buy it on eBay, on Amazon or whatever, and you type in the key that you were given and say activate, and it activates, the odds are fairly high it's legitimate software. It wouldn't have activated. And if it doesn't activate, you ask for your money back. Now it starts to get tricky because people will distribute software which has had divots chunked out of it, had pieces taken out in such a way that it either doesn't need activating or gives a false alarm. The worst possible scenario is where somebody has stolen the license keys that belong to a school or college, what they call a VLK, a volume licensing. Now, in general, what you can do is if you buy, let's say in your case, you buy AutoCAD, what is it, 12, or there was a popular version, 14, which goes back, you could tell me, maybe 10 years or something.
Yeah.
To the best of my knowledge, that software was old enough that it did not activate over the internet. It just had a key and a challenge and a couple other things, so it knew what legitimate keys were, and the same key would activate multiple copies. If you really want to know, the thing to do is actually communicate with the company and say, I'm about to get software, is this key legitimate? Actually communicate directly with the company, like AutoCAD.
Yeah.
It may well be.
Now, the people that sell that, I mean, it's on the internet. It's like they have whatever version, like 2013 or 2014, real pretty current version.
Okay.
And yet they don't support, you don't get support, but I mean, if you just want the software, and they say they provide the key for it.
That's, you're in a gray area there, because what happens is, for example, you can legitimately yourself get Microsoft Office Home and School Edition or something, I think they call it. And they don't appear to care a whole lot who buys it. They sell it as staples and so on. But what will happen is if you buy that version, you will not get support and you cannot use it as an upgrade path.
Yeah.
As long as you're aware of that, and somewhere on the packaging it will actually say that. So it's not a cut-down version, it's a full version. But the thing that makes people feel
it seems to be a full version.
Yeah,
so I didn't want to get illegal software. But I mean, if it's old software that didn't sell and now it's not current because they don't sell anything but the current version.
Right, and the other thing that happens is, let's suppose that, I'm sorry, is that Steve?
Yeah.
Okay, let's suppose, Steve, that you had a 10-year-old piece of software you wanted to give or sell to me or somebody else. You paid for that license. You should be able to do that. How do you do that? Well, technically what you have to do is deactivate your license the same as you would if you moved it from machine A to machine B. It's licensed for one machine. You're supposed to, I love this, don't you? How circumspect. You're supposed to be able to deactivate the key so it becomes unlicensed software so that the key is now available for the next department, next consumer, next individual. You're transferring the license. Are you allowed to do that, given that the license came from the company? It's a gray area, but in general, the Justice Department says you don't own the license, you are licensed to use the software on one machine. And you go, well, is it licensed to the person or the machine? It gets very gray in the end, and the answer is, I'd call up the 800 number of the company and tell them what you've told me, and I'd be really interested to know what they said.
Yeah.
They might say, we don't bloody care.
A lot of lawsuits. They've had a lot of lawsuits about selling even the old books for the old literature, you know, like the whatever, the Lisp routines or whatever, the manuals. You're not even allowed to sell that, I thought.
My feeling is, and I've seen this happening on Amazon, where there was vendors selling deregistered software, and Adobe came after them like a ton of bricks and shut them down. And the answer is they did because they could. So the average vendor on Amazon hasn't got the horsepower that a big corporation's got, so they just went under, just kowtowed to it. And it turned out that probably wasn't legal.
And CAD software, from my memory, has always been one of those softwares to where there have not been good alternatives in the open source community. Paul just brought that up, and he found FreeCAD.
Now, the deal is, if you're doing this as a professional, you probably can't afford to struggle with compatibility. It has to be the right thing, because you can't afford to screw up. Am I guessing right?
Yes, and also, I think they just lease you per year nowadays.
They love that stuff. Mm-hmm. They totally love that stuff. Everybody's doing that now.
And so that's about $1,000 a year.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that lends itself to the question, well, the likes of AutoCAD, which you don't use, you just happen to mention the name, these companies would quite like you to do the annual subscription routine, so therefore they wouldn't like you to get the previous editions that didn't need a subscription. They would do everything they can to have you not do that, because that's what you are trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And so, I think I do have my original floppies, the 5.5-inch disk.
5.5-inch. Oh.
I mean, one of the reasons, Steve, and I know our thriftier listeners will go right along with this, is you could buy an older version of the software legitimately and use it as an upgrade path. So if a piece of software was $400, but it was $200 if you had the previous version, and you went on the internet and bought the previous CD for $20, you're ahead. Well, the companies didn't like that either.
Yeah.
But you should be able to do that.
Okay. Hey, well, thank you.
Oh,
you're
yeah,
very welcome,
and
Steve.
Keep us posted with the software that you don't use, okay?
Okay.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
And let's go on to our next call, and you are live on the air. Thanks for holding. What's your first name?
Doug.
Hey, Doug, how are you today?
Amazingly well.
Good.
Any rate, back to the guy with the portable telephone.
Uh-huh.
If the phone is built for NiCads, fine. If not, you know, NiCads are only 1.2 volts.
Right.
And if you were running two in there, he's already 4/10 of a volt short of where he should be, and maybe not enough juice to trigger the circuitry.
Hi, you know, Doug, I thought of that, and on two fronts, it's interesting. I made the probably faulty assumption that nearly every cordless phone I've seen, for reasons known to itself, appears to have NiCads in it.
Right.
And the other is it doesn't... No, you know, I'm incorrect about that, because if he used whatever the previous battery was... Well, if it's rechargeable, there's only two choices, nickel-cadmium or nickel-metal hydride, right?
Right, right.
One of them is 1.2-something, and the other one is 1.5, I think it is.
I'm not sure about that.
That's a good point. All the phones I've ever seen have been using NiCads, even up to the present day, which is a bit bizarre. So, Doug, I would refer you to Neil, was it?
Yes.
And I just assumed that he got the same type of batteries it was, but we know what they say about assumptions, so I stand corrected. I shouldn't have started with that assumption.
I do have a scanner that has a switch inside the battery box that switches between alkaline or... NiCad.
Oh,
I've seen that. Yeah, I've seen that, and had another device years ago. I know what it was. It was a GPS device, and on the configuration screen, it did ask me what kind of batteries I'd got.
Right.
And the reason it asked that, it was it didn't actually seem to care, but then what happens is the battery meter got it wrong about how much charge was left.
Well, that's the other thing is if he does have a base station, you know, maybe it's not putting out enough juice to charge those batteries.
I got the impression the batteries were charged up because they did work in a flashlight, but when put in the phone, they didn't work. But what you described would explain is if you put two 1.2-volt batteries in there for 2.4 volts, and the original battery produced 1.5 volts,
right.
That would explain that scenario.
Exactly, and that's why one alkaline and one NiCad is enough voltage to be over the threshold.
Sure, and as I mentioned, for the reasons before, it might work, but... You're not really supposed to mix batteries for very practical reasons, like overheating and wearing them out and so forth.
Especially in charging.
Thanks for the heads up, Doug. I appreciate
it. Not a problem. Glad to be there.
All right.
Bye-bye now. And a programming note, we're coming up to the end of the hour. I want to let you know that we're on here at KVMR-FM Nevada City, KCPC Camino Placerville. Zentech airs the 2nd, 4th, and odd today, 5th Wednesday of each month. Next month, on February 13th, which is when we would normally be on, our membership drive is going to be going on. So Pauline and I have the day off.
Yay.
So we will be here once in February, and that will be on the 27th of February. So we're going to be gone for about a month.
So I have one in February, and that's it. And it's said that the Romans developed the month of February to shave off all the days to make up to the correct number of months and days, but also because it was the coldest and darkest month, so they decided to make it
the shortest one.
So the story goes.
Do you want to take this last call real quick?
Yeah,
or do you have some closing?
I've got some homework, but let's listen to people instead of me.
Okay. Good afternoon, caller. Very quickly, you're live on the air. What's your first name?
Paul.
Hi, Paul. What do you have for us?
I have a quick question. I have a son who's disabled. He's on SSI. We're going to be traveling to Portland for his sister's wedding.
Uh-huh.
And I want to be able to... He doesn't have a cell phone because he keeps losing it, but I want him to have one up in Portland. And I was told First of all, that he's got to have at least a 4G phone in order to get Verizon or whatever other service. And second, somebody told me that if he's on SSI, he gets a free phone. So I'm wondering if you know anything about either of those two issues.
I've seen ads for that, which is free cell phones for people on SSI. You got to be very careful about scamming going on there, but I've definitely seen that. Mm-hmm. What you actually get, I'm not sure. Are we talking a flip phone, or is it necessary to get a smartphone?
No, just a flip phone. I don't want to get him a smartphone. Yeah. Just a flip phone. Just so if he wanders off, I have some way of reaching him.
Now, the bottom line there is I would suggest if the... I would Google that. I don't know the answer.
And Paul, I have a little bit more specific information, and that is call the county social worker, and they can tell you about this. I know there are services out there, and the state does provide for those folks within certain income levels free cell phones and cell phone services. The reason for that was to get phones into the hands of many of the homeless people. But I would recommend that you call whichever social service you use and speak to a worker there, and they can direct you to what's available and how to get that.
I do see here there are a lot of ads, but you've got to be careful about scamming here. But enough people are mentioning in Google cell phones for SSI free, so try that. The other thing is track phones are cheap.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
All right, you're welcome.
Thanks, Paul. And we're going to have to head out. We've got Michael Young coming up next this afternoon with, can you read that, Paulie, because I can't. Oh, Standards. There we go. Standards with Michael Young.
Mm-hmm. I got a quick 2-minute last.
Yes. Yeah, just about.
I bought a tiny virtual server for $3.50. Unbelievable. I've listed the sites of VULTR and DigitalOcean. You can't say that it's a bad thing to be out of pocket to the tune of $3.50 to get yourself a virtual server. It's got 20 gigabytes of storage and, I forget, limited resources. But if you want to thrash around and fancy yourself as an internet engineer and thrash around with the stuff, unbelievable. I managed to install an instance of Ubuntu in under 5 minutes and be up and running. You might say that's because I knew what I was doing. If you follow the instructions, you will get where I got, which is you'll have a server out on the internet with an IP address with Linux running on it, if that's your inclination, and you can hack the living daylights out of that thing for $3.50. Unbelievable.
Is that per month, or is that it's...
Monthly fee, month to month, yep. You can do it through PayPal. Just make sure you turn off auto-refresh renew. And the final one was, thanks to my friend Ralph and to myself, for tearing an iPod Classic apart following the instructions. It was one of the most devastatingly complex things I've ever done, given that I did not want to wreck my iPod Classic, which I've had for years. Mm-hmm. A stainless steel case. It takes needles, tweezers, leather gloves so you don't gouge your hand out, and it has a 1.8-inch 40-pin, 160-gigabyte spinning parallel ATA hard drive. I learned all this. Fascinating stuff. Absolutely fascinating. I got the battery replaced, but broke the end connector. That's the way it always goes. So there you go. Tiny, teeny little hard drives inside iPod Classics. Thanks for listening to my ramblings, folks.
We'll see you in a month. And again,